So settling into our posture, however you are comfortable and however you find it most supportive to try to gather your awareness. So I find it helpful to try to get into a kind of alignment where the body feels upright but not tense, where there's a feeling of balance in the body. So I'm not tilted. And of course, wherever you are, if you need to be in a lying prone position, that's fine. Walking, standing, these are all the postures that the Buddha talks about practicing in. So if you're sitting or lying down, you can close your eyes or just lower your gaze, turning the attention inward. So noticing how you're feeling right now. The word feeling can refer to different types of experience, whether it's physical sensations, emotions, mood, your kind of mental state. It's helpful to check in with each of them. How is your body feeling? What is your mood? What's going on with your thoughts this morning or whatever time of day it is for you? And then bringing in the breath. The breath can become a partner in our awareness. The breath is a partner with the sensations in the body. It's a partner with the mood and emotions. It's a partner with the mental states and the thoughts. The breath can be used as an agent of calm. So to calm the body, settle the body. We breathe with the body. We breathe with the sensations. The breath can be used to calm the emotions. We breathe with the feelings, with the emotions, releasing, settling. we breathe with the thoughts, the mental formations, the creations of mind. The breath calms these mental formations. The breath rests in the center of awareness. It's the partner of every other experience. As this central focus, it serves to unify the mind. To bring the attention into focus, into concentration. It is our home to which we return whenever the mind, heart is disturbed. We can focus on the breath in a very narrow and tight way in order to really strengthen that concentration and exclude any distraction. But we take the attention in very close to the minute sensations of the in-breath, the out-breath. the breath can also be more expansive as we open. Open to the broader mind that contains breath. So we need to maintain a sensitivity to the needs of our practice in each moment. If we are scattered and agitated, perhaps we make more effort to tighten the focus. If we feel constricted, closed in, and we open to this broader space of awareness. Both are useful approaches, not one better than the other. This requires us to stay attuned and even experiment with these different types of focus. During any given sitting, we may move between different levels of effort and openness or tightness. With any kind of effort in our meditation, we want to be careful that we are bringing a quality of kindness, a gentleness to that effort. If there is a forced effort or a sense of lack or failure that we're responding to, then the meditation becomes in some sense counterproductive. The essence of practice is letting go. And one of the things we have to let go of is a sense of being good, succeeding, failing, striving. All of that must be put aside. We are our own dear one, our own dear friend, supporting our effort to be present and to enrich our lives. We always want to bring that attitude of kindness and support to ourselves, just as we would to a friend. Even when we find ourselves striving or judging ourselves to try to bring kindness even to that striving, even to that judging. Compassion, understanding, caring. All right. So we're with the waiting room, you know, once we start the meditation, either Monica or I is kind of trying to keep an eye on it. But if you wind up, you know, waiting in the waiting room, it means we're meditating. And so you could just meditate while you're waiting, because it's no different. It's only a concept as to whether you are, you know, you know, I can't meditate because I'm in the waiting room. Wait, nothing's happening in the other room. They're just sitting. So, you know, that's a pro tip for today. I personally am having a bit of an existential crisis. I knew I should not have started. I knew I should not have. I didn't want to watch the Beatles documentary, but I also knew I had to watch it. And so it's, you know, my over-identification with George Harrison is throwing me into emotional distress. And then I find myself identifying with Paul McCartney. And then I'm worried. I think John Lennon's like on heroin or something. I don't know what's wrong with him. And the whole thing is upsetting me. But you know, once you start watching it, you have to keep going. So yeah, here we are, in December. What is it? The 14th, December 14th, I think. And, you know, we're getting towards the end of One Breath at a Time. Speaking of existential crises, I'm going to have to figure out what to do next after almost 2 years of going through this book. I mean, hopefully by now everybody's forgotten the beginning. We could just go back to the beginning, but we'll do something. But we're in step 12, and I think, because it's like, I don't know. I'm trying to figure out where we are. I think we're, you know, I think we did showing up last time. And so I think we're at breadth of practice, all our affairs. And I was going over this morning, and basically it's going through the Eightfold Path. So maybe we'll spend some time, however much time we can and we need, going through the Eightfold Path. Certainly never hurts. But the focus of this section is sort of applying Dharma to our daily lives rather than to our meditation. Per se, or to deepening meditation, which, you know, back in step 11, there was a section called depth of practice, I think. Wasn't there? I thought there was. Yeah, depth of practice beats. So now this is breadth of practice, all our affairs. And I'll just mention that the next section is called breadth of practice, daily mindfulness. So kind of trying to get these, kind of placing practice and seeing the applications of practice in different ways, kind of looking at, you know, as I said, the depth of practice was like, how deep can my meditation go, you know, going on retreats, and what the value of that, which is critical, really, really important. You know, something that comes up over and over, certainly in this book and in really all my writing. I've talked about too, one of the problems that can arise is we become overly attached to the depth of practice, to the retreat experience. And you know, I don't really want to call it addictive, because it doesn't have the same negative connotations or harmful effects of addiction. But nonetheless, if we start to think that the only value in our Dharma practice is getting really deep meditation experiences, then we're kind of tossing out all the spiritual opportunities that our daily lives offer us. So I'll read a little bit of this section. It's on page 267 of One Breath at a Time. In step 11, I talked about depth of practice, the vital foundation for spiritual development. When I first began to practice Buddhist meditation, I thought that retreats were the only meaningful form of practice. As I talked about in step 10, I had the idea that if I could just do enough retreats, I'd be okay, and that otherwise I would inevitably lose my concentration and mindfulness. This was an addictive way to approach meditation, trying to sustain the high. Through daily mindfulness and developing other qualities as well, I began to see that my growth was broader than just the development of deep states of meditation. When step 12 says we should practice these principles in all our affairs, it sends us off into the world with the ultimate task. Don't just do this stuff at special times, do it all the time. How can we manage this? Well, the Buddhist teaching on the Eightfold Path is a great guide. Again, the path starts with right view. Here we see the truth clearly that there is suffering and the possibility of freedom from suffering. This inspires us to live our life in a way that will free us and others from suffering. This is step one. And it is also step 12. In step one, we see suffering in its most basic way, in our disease or dysfunction. In step 12, we see that we need to address suffering in all our affairs. When we perfect right view, this is enlightenment. We see the truth without the fog of delusion, of fantasy, of fear and resentment. This is where the moment-to-moment practice of returning to the breath, to mindfulness, guides us. So right view is something that deserves its own special attention. And I think in the context of daily practice, or breadth of practice, all our affairs, it's really about one way of saying it is how we interpret our experience, and to realize that we are interpreting our experience. There's, I think, a natural tendency for us to think, well, that happened, something happened, that's just the way it is, and not necessarily to see that the way we are understanding something that happens is conditioned. Reality, there are real things that happen, but the way they are understood is always through our own perceptual mechanism, and particularly through our own, I don't want to say analytical mechanism, but it's not quite the right word. In any case, it's an interpretive experience. And so right view is trying to give us ways to interpret things. So the Buddha, first of all, he characterizes right view as sort of these two main elements, which are seeing the Four Noble Truths, seeing suffering, its cause, the way to end it, and seeing cause and effect, seeing the law of karma. So that's a starting point, but I don't think it's the end point in terms of this being like a functional tool for us, because the way I view right view is something that I need to remind myself. And there's a few things that I try to remind myself of. Yeah, and one is, oh, if there's suffering right now, it's because there's clinging. And what are the ways to get out of that? That's, oh, it's the Eightfold Path. So that's the whole sort of cycle around the Four Noble Truths that you kind of are drawing on. But in terms of the sort of almost immediate interpretation, the three characteristics, impermanence, suffering, and not self, give us even more sort of direct reminders. And I would point to impermanence as sort of the central one, the one that's easiest to call upon and to kind of remember, because it's so evident. And it so often is needed to remember impermanence. And that's because I think that human minds have a tendency to solidify things or to think of things as solid, I think is a better way to put it. And so when an event happens, there's a thought, there's the sense or the felt experience of, like, I just got a job, right? Let's say you just got a new job. There's a sense, now I have a job, and this is the way it is, and it's a solid thing, and it's not going to change, right? I'm sick. Now I'm sick. That I'm just going to be sick. I'm sad. I'm just going to be sad, you know, and on and on, right? That there's always a sense of kind of, that's the way it is. And that belief, that interpretation, this, that misinterpretation of reality then has these implications that it, because it affects our thinking and it affects our behaviors. And, you know, particularly around emotions, you know, when there's a sense that, you know, I'm depressed and I'm always going to be depressed, you know, there's despair that comes through that versus, oh, I'm feeling sad, I'm feeling blue. I could call this depression, okay, but it's impermanent. I'll deal with it. I'll get through it. I'll be okay. No despair, just, you know, unpleasant experience. You know, I was doing some of the pre-op preparation yesterday where they're testing my blood, testing my, you know, asking me all these questions about my health history. And then everything that they're doing is an attempt to make sure that I don't die tomorrow. They don't say that. They don't put it in those terms. But, like, I have to take a shower with this antibacterial soap because, you know, there's two ways that people usually die in hospitals. One is the anesthesia. The other is with infections. That's why hospitals are so dangerous. So I'm like, oh, you're doing this so I won't die. And of course the people there are like, why are you saying that? Like, that's not, but it's true, right? And it, because, and of course death is the ultimate expression of impermanence. It's certainly the most important element of impermanence for each of us. And yet we walk around and act as if and sort of feel as if it's not going to happen. You know? I mean, I find myself from time to time thinking, you know, gee, I could do this with my life, like something that would involve like a 30-year cycle, right? Like I could, you know, I'd really like to study this and maybe move there and, you know, a new career. And it's like, oh, wait, I'm not going to be alive that long. Okay, good. That's cool. But it's just that tendency, right, of the mind to think that the state of being alive, well, that's a permanent thing. You know, of course, I've only ever known being alive. I don't remember not being alive. It'd be difficult to, although, you know, supposedly people remember past lives. I don't know. But I just, as you can tell by the fact that I'm laughing about this, that I find it very freeing, to like, you know, to just like, oh yeah, right, that's cool, that's okay. And you know, in our meditation practice, you know, this is, it's not what it's about, but it's one of the things that it's about. Watching your moment-to-moment experience and seeing how it's changing, how it's unstable, it's unconstant. And becoming comfortable with that. Right there in our meditation, what do we find ourselves wanting to do? I think most of the time what we find ourselves wanting to do is stop. Make everything stop. Make my thoughts stop. Make my everything just feel solid. And, you know, I want to concentrate. And it's like, I want that concentration to be like a mountain, to be solid as a rock. In other words, I want things to be permanent in some way. I want some like just stable state to arise that's permanent. And if we meditate a lot, we can get to a place where there is this feeling of stability. But it's so important to like see that even in that felt sense, there is constant movement. That the body and the mind are streams of energy. They never stop. They're never solid. And so truly, an important aspect of our meditation training is for us to be acutely sensitized to impermanence. And thereby to become really almost devoted to letting go, to just like to be totally connected with like, yes, it's just go, 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 you know, and so that whatever change happens, there's no resistance, you know, there's no struggle, there's no conflict. It's just, yes, yes, yes. You know, and I'm saying all this, and I certainly don't, this isn't how I experience my life. I have moments of it, and I keep trying to remind myself of it. But, you know, I don't want you to think that I'm, you know, transmitting some, you know, thing that I've attained. But it's definitely, you know, what I'm pointing at and what I see as right view, you know, what really is right view. So I just really want to encourage people to kind of take their practice, not just about impermanence, because there's more to see. So, you know, I think it's really valuable to just ask the question, how am I understanding my experience? And is that understanding attuned to the Dharma? You know, and so in a much more sort of mundane version of this, blaming others, right? You know, so which is about karma, right? What you did, you know, made me feel this, or it's your fault, you know, a classic way that we interpret our experience, like, and that we create suffering. And this is one of the things that the 12 steps really point to, right? The inventory process is asking ourselves, and it is trying to get at this question of what's true, you know, and it's a question of cause and effect. So this is part of right view. It's like, okay, what is the causal relationship here? You know, the idea that you, like a typical, you know, a typical wrong view is you made me feel this, right? And realizing like, oh, like if someone could make me feel things, then life would be very different. You know, if somebody who I wasn't attracted to could make me love them, that would be really interesting. And if I could take care of my child, if I could make my child happy, you know, that'd be wonderful. You know, if I could make certain people miserable, that would be great. You know, some people I can think of that I could just like, boy, I'd really like to make them unhappy, you know, but we can't make people feel things. And so it's, you know, this is a great, like, right view point, right? Like, oh, what am I believing right now? That person's behavior, the way I'm reacting to it, I'm blaming them for that. It's like, oh, that's interesting. And they, you know, the person might be a complete jerk and behaving really inappropriately, unskillfully, and that's really unpleasant. However, those are a few words on right view. That's only one of eight. So this, I mean, maybe I can stretch out this section for eight sessions. We'll see. That's what I'm feeling today. So I'll just open it up if there's any thoughts or questions, reflections today.
Hi.
Hello.
I just have a question. Is there a book you can recommend that sort of encompasses all these Buddhist lists, you know, like the Eightfold Path and the this and the that? Is there something that's not too complicated that would just present that? I'm just thinking, I hear and I read and then I get confused and think, which list is that? So I was wondering if you could suggest something where you could
I get that question from time to time, and I don't really have a great answer for it. It's something that I've thought about putting together, because I don't think it's so much that we need a book as sort of a booklet that's just like the hierarchy of Buddhist lists. That's like a reference point. And you go, okay, all right, the Four Noble Truths of the Eightfold Path. Okay. Oh, the three characteristics, the four Brahmaviharas, the seven factors of awakening. There's really not that many lists, and they're, some of them are directly connected to others, and others seem to stand more on their own. And I've kind of put in some work on a project like that. What did I call it? I called it Buddhist Basics. Yeah, here it is. Oh, and it looks like I have about 20 files on that. yeah, so I have thought about this book. And because yeah, I don't have an answer for you. At this point, the thing I think, well, I think some of Joseph Goldstein's books, I think The Experience of Insight is a great one. And his book, Mindfulness, that's a pretty big one. It's a big project to go through. Maybe I'll put together just, Lee Brazington on his website, I think he has a list of lists.
I don't want to give you more things to do.
It's my job, man. It's my job. So, I'll do a little work on this in the next few days and see if I can bring something back to the group that'll be helpful. Meanwhile, I see Mary Helen has her virtual hand up. Hello. Yes,
Kevin. Hi. This, I might have missed this early on, but I was curious about what surgery you're contemplating.
Contemplating. It's just a hernia. It's the third time I've had one, so it's not a thrill.
Okay, I'll send you Meta.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Mostly I'm like, it's the drugs that are troubling for me. And not that I mind drugs, it's just they ultimately feel pretty crappy. Okay, as I've been talking, I've been looking at Lee Brazington's website. And here is, he's got a list of lists. You can try this. There we go. I love the way nobody talks about anything that I've been talking about. What about that great guided meditation I did this morning? We should be, talking about how great that. I'm really, just FYI, for those who've been following along for the last week or two, or have not been following along, I probably should say, on my recent retreat, I started some more study of the Sutta on mindfulness of breathing, and I am getting more into that practice. So that's kind of where my guided meditations are going. Okay. Wow, we've got a bunch of recommendations here. Look at all this. Let's see. Mindfulness by Joseph Goldstein. Yeah. IMC list of lists online. Okay. So IMC has that. Buddhism, spirituality, that's okay. A list of Buddhist lists. A Spirit Rock as an intro to Buddhism, the Recovery Dharma Handbook. Pema Chodron's coming through the Tibetan tradition, which doesn't really cover this stuff in the same way as I do. And just to say, like, when I talk about Buddhism, I'm really talking about Theravadan Buddhism. So that's a whole other discussion, that there are different schools with different teachings. But Theravadan Buddhism is the earliest form and the most direct form of Buddhism, a most direct connection to the Buddha, rather than like people who came after him. So Jeff, did you want to say something?
Yeah, just very quickly, you were the principle of impermanence is and you expressed some thought about wanting something to be solid and permanent. Well, that's one thing that definitely is the principle of impermanence is a permanent principle. I wake up every day because of a back injury. I wake up every day in a fair amount of pain. Sometimes, you know, bring me to tears kind of pain.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm able to go through that without drugs or drinking.
Yeah.
Because I am aware that if I get myself out of the bed,
yeah,
into the hot shower, yeah, move the body around a little bit, the relief will come. And I've been dealing with this for 3.5 years right now. So it's clear to me that even the suffering is there is not a permanent amount of suffering.
Right.
And I loved you saying, I loved your thing that you said about we all think we're going to live forever, you know, because yeah, we don't know anything else.
Right. Yeah.
You know, and then shockingly, somebody we know and love goes away, disappears in that way.
Yeah.
And it just stops the world. You have to consider the, oh, that might happen to me.
Yeah.
In 5 days, I will be seven decades long.
Oh, congratulations.
And, well, thank you. But my father lasted about 7 decades.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
Thank you for your time and your attention.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Jeff. Boy, you got me going in a couple of directions, and so naturally I'm lost now, going in different directions. Debbie, you had your hand up and you took it down. Don't think you're going to escape that easily.
I was looking at the clock. Thank you. Yeah, my
time is relative.
There you go. My reflection also is on impermanence, and thank you so much for meditation practice relative to all of that. I really appreciated learning to go into meditation with the basic essence of touching into what's present now and kind of an exploration of what's here right now with a sense of freedom and then seeing where it goes, which is very supportive for me. And also I wanted to just kind of share this first time years ago that I kind of experienced and touched into the fact of impermanence. And it was through mindfulness of breath. It was through meditation on the breathing, realizing if I don't breathe out, breath can't come in. And then saying, well, this is not even at the cellular level, but this must be reflective of things even smaller and lesser apparent to me. And then that brought me to reflecting on nature. So the truth of life is everything that exists is reflective of everything that exists.
Mm.
So what do we see from things that we don't even see is this truth of impermanence. To the biggest thing that we see, the changing of the sky, the changing of the clouds, the movement of the earth, that whatever it is. And so I had this awakening of get in the flow, Deb.
Yeah.
Don't hold on. Yeah. Get in the flow and just, you know, experience it one day at a time, one time at a time, whatever. And sometimes the waters are rough. A lot of times the waters are rough, but through the practice and acknowledgement that this too shall pass and I have a choice, I can contribute to it passing faster or slower, or if I am like verklempt, I can let go totally and it naturally will take its own rhythm of coming and going. So I just wanted to share that. Thank you so much for this morning.
Yeah, nice. Thank you. And I guess something sort of came together for me in listening to you, which is, I know this might sound silly, but lately I've been sort of noticing that daylight ends at it seems like it's just day, like it's just going on. And then it's sort of this sudden change. And also in the morning, like if you get up early now in the winter, it's dark. And it's like, and then next thing you know, like I'll be meditating and I'll start meditating in the dark. And then the meditation is over and I open my eyes and it's light. And I realize that what is the change sudden? That's really, really important principle. It's a principle of enlightenment, the gradual path and sudden awakening. But it's also like a principle of climate change and a principle of politics and a principle of relationships, you know, and everything. It's like everything looks stable for a while, but and we know like, oh, it's gradually changing. But then suddenly there's this radical change. And I think climate change is really obvious around that, that for a long time, you know, those of us who have been alive for, you know, a fair number of decades know that there's been this like, oh, well, first of all, like we knew that there were problems. I mean, that's why they started Earth Day back in like 1970, you know, 50 years. Hard to believe that's 50 years, but I believe it is. My math is right, 51 years. And then we started to notice things, you know, and now Al Gore said, you know, there's going to be problems. And then in the last decade, in the last 5 years, it's like, whoa, things are, it's sudden, right? So anyway, I just bring that up because I think that's another aspect of right view, because we get surprised by the sudden change and we don't see it happening. And then it's the sudden break, you know, things build up to a point and then there's a break. It's like you're pregnant for a while and it just seems like you're pregnant, and then suddenly there's this being in the world. Well, that was sudden. Anyway, I do plan on being here on Friday night. I actually am concerned about Christmas Eve, which would be the next Friday night, because we as a family are invited somewhere. So I'm not sure what's going to happen on Christmas Eve. Just putting that out. I don't want to abandon people on Christmas Eve. I would be just as happy to just stay home. But I don't think it would be skillful. Just to let you know, that's up in the air a little bit. We'll see what happens. If there are any volunteers who want to just lead the meeting that night, we can do it that way. Or I could like maybe go into the bathroom on my phone and say hi to people. But anyway, that's the future. So as of now, I just will hope to see you all on Friday night.